chapter 3, where it talks about the first things that Solomon did. You know, he's now king, he's been crowned, word has gone out, he has gotten rid of people who have tried to overthrow it or take it by force. He's gotten rid of them, and now it's his to keep. And what is he going to do? And before I actually get into the fifth verse, which talks about the gift that God's going to give Solomon, I have to go back to the start of chapter 3, verse 5. I want to pick up with verse 3 and 4, where it says, "And Solomon loved the Lord." We know from hindsight of reading about Solomon that Solomon had two great loves. He loved the Lord, and he loved strange women. And we'll know that, and we'll follow that, not only today, but as we go forward in talking about Solomon. And in those categories, when you love two things, you can't love God and man, or mammon, and what one would draw him, give him great wisdom, the others would draw him away. But it says, "And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, only," or meaning except, "he sacrificed and burnt incense in high places." Now, when you study that, they really don't want to, there's not a whole lot theologians can tell you what that means. When you just read it, you immediately think back to paganistic worship, don't you? Because when they would go in the Old Testament and they would worship paganistic gods, they would go to the high places and the groves and they would offer incense. It doesn't say Solomon did that, and we don't know enough about Solomon's his history before being king to assume that he's doing that. And it's only in the next verse that we realize that he's offering to God. He's actually going to the high places where there was no temple, there was a tabernacle still, but he would go to the high places, and the Bible makes a point saying only he sacrificed and burned. He loved the Lord and followed the statutes, except he burned incense. All right, so we go into verse 4, "And the king, Solomon, went to Gibeon to sacrifice there." Gibeon was the highest place in that part of Judea where they would sacrifice. Because there was no temple, people would sacrifice at the high places they could go to, or if they could get to the tabernacle, they would do that. Now, Gibeah is important because in our history, it tells us that when Joshua led the children of Israel across the River Jordan, they carried the tabernacle, Moses' tabernacle, which we've talked about in the previous few months. They brought the tabernacle over, and Joshua set it up in a place called Shiloh. That's where the tabernacle would reside as the children of Israel populated the land of Canaan. Later, when Saul took the crown, became the first king, he moved the tabernacle to Gibeon. And it was the highest place on the plain, and he wanted it there. So now it's been there all this time. Now, the interesting part of this story is King Saul moves the tabernacle with the Ark of the Covenant to Gibeon. David becomes king and had a goal from the very beginning that Jerusalem would be the city of God, that God had instilled this all the way back to when David killed Goliath and David brought Goliath's head back to Jerusalem. Jerusalem wasn't the capital city at that time, and David lets us know at that point that his intention one day was he always believed that Jerusalem was the city of God. So he's now king. David goes into the tabernacle, takes the Ark of the Covenant, taken from them during some of the wars, and David won it back. And instead of bringing it back to the tabernacle in Gibeon, he brings it to Jerusalem. He leaves the tabernacle. Moses' tabernacle is still in Gibeon. The brazen altar, still in Gibeon. You know, all that we studied. But the Ark, the heart of the whole thing, Ark of the Covenant, is now in Jerusalem. David put it under a tent there in Jerusalem before the house of God was built, before the temple was built, before the king's palace was built. David, in his heart, wanted the Ark of the Covenant in Jerusalem, and he brings it there. So now we pick up with Solomon now as the king, and the first thing he's wanting to do now as king is he's wanting to worship. He's wanting to offer thanksgiving to God. And it says, "And the king went to Gibeon." He went to the tabernacle where the brazen altar is. And we assume that that's the purpose and the reason he went to Gibeon is because he wanted to offer not incense, but he wanted to offer, produce burnt offerings unto God. And that's where the brazen altar was. For that was the great high place. 1,000 burnt offerings did Solomon offer upon that altar. 1,000 bulls he slew and offered on that altar. Now, everything Solomon did was just over the top, it seems. It tells us that he loved the Lord, and he's wanting to show his love by offering an overabundance. 1,000 bulls would perish in this time period that he is offering unto the Lord. Now, when we get to verse 5, after all of that has happened, he's still in Gibeon. He's offered 1,000 bulls, and he goes to sleep. And in verse 5, it says, "In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, 'Ask what I shall give thee.' And Solomon said, 'Thou hast shown unto thy servant David my father great mercy, according as he walked before thee in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with thee, and thou hast kept for him this great kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on the throne as it is this day.'" This is Solomon's response back to God. "And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant, myself, king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this thy so great a people?" I want to stop there. For my whole life, when I knew about this story and when I read this story, it never dawned on me, even though it's plain right there in front of you, it never dawned on me that this was a dream. I always assumed that God and Solomon are having a conversation. Remember when God woke up Samuel when he was a boy and Hannah had delivered him to the priest, and Samuel would wake up and he'd run to the priest thinking the priest had called him? "No, I haven't called you. Go back to sleep." And then the Lord would speak to him again. Samuel woke up and had a conversation with the Lord. This time, Solomon is dreaming this whole thing. He's dreaming it because, you know, when you get to the point where you're thinking, boy, what an incredible statement for Solomon to make as a young man, first time apparently that God has spoken to him, Almighty God has come down to Solomon and is speaking, at, "What do you want me to give you?" What a great question, what a great offer from God, first of all, and what an incredible response that Solomon, this young man, has given, an incredible response he's given to God. Very fluid, very poetic, very strong, very humble. But the whole time, he's dreaming this. He's seeing it in his dream. God is showing him a conversation that he is having with Solomon. "This is a conversation I'm having with you in your dream." And he's asking Solomon, and Solomon in his dreaming is hearing what God is offering, and he's hearing what he himself is offering back to God, saying, "You've had mercy on my father David. You've shown him kindness. You've even shown kindness to me that you should grant me this opportunity to be the king. Now, O Lord, hear what I have to say. I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in. Give me an understanding heart to be able to discern right from wrong, good from bad." All this is so what Solomon is hearing. He's visualizing this in his dream. And we'll come back at the end of this, and he'll wake up and realize that it's a dream, and he'll do something. All right, so he's seeing all this in his dream. Now, the interesting part is he is saying that I am but a little child, and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to come in and go out. He's not really a little child here. He's about 20 years old when he takes over the kingship here, when he becomes king. And not only is he a 20-year-old young man, but he's already married. He's, you know, and we read this, if we remember, we go back to the very first verse of chapter 3. It says, and Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, or an agreement or a treaty with Pharaoh of Egypt, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had made an end of building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall of Jerusalem round about. In other words, he married Pharaoh's daughter, a strange woman. He married a strange woman, which this wasn't uncommon in biblical days. If you had an enemy, you marry the leader of the enemy's daughter. And that kind of brought everything together where you had a treaty. You know, I've married your daughter. I can't understand a word she says because she's got a different language than I do. But I married her. And now that we're together, we won't war against each other. And that's what he's doing here with Pharaoh. He married his daughter. Now, we know this because his son, Rehoboam, his first son, is going to be 41 years old when he takes over the reign of Israel. Solomon only reigns for 40 years. That means he's not only married, but he's got a son by the time he's 20 years old. Rehoboam is already born when Solomon is having this dream of, I am but a little child, I know not how to go out and come in. He's sensing what he is seeing, what God is showing him that he is saying. But yet it doesn't take away from the power of what the conversation is. Solomon in his own self could have easily asked for riches and for a long life and all of these things, as any young man would have asked for, most likely, given the opportunity. You know, if you have anything you want, what would it be? Man, wouldn't we all like to hear that from God? And but yet, in what Solomon's response is, whether it's a dream given by God for Solomon to remember or whatever, the response is wonderfully humble and wonderfully wise in its own right. He is asking for an understanding heart. The word understanding here in the Greek means hearing. Let me have a heart that hears, that understands the situation. You know, what is a wisdom that he is asking for, that he can judge this great people? He knows that being the leader, he's going to have to break apart all the alliances. He's going to have to settle the disputes. He's going to be literally the judge of the people. And if anyone needs wisdom, it's a judge, isn't it? You know, a judge needs to have wisdom, not favoritism, not biases. He needs to have wisdom to know how to discern between good and bad with the situation at hand. And he's asking for that. And God is pleased with the response because still in the dream, it says in verse 10, and the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said unto him in the dream, because thou hast asked this thing, and hast not asked for thyself long life, neither have you asked for riches, nor hast asked for the life of thine enemies, but hast asked for thyself understanding to discern judgment, behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall any arise like unto thee. And I have also given thee that which thou hast not asked. I'm going to give you the riches and the honor. You didn't ask for it, but because you didn't, I'm going to give it to you anyway, on top of everything else that I'm giving you with the wisdom, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee in all thy days. So how about that? He's dreaming this, and he's hearing what God is going to grant him, not only the wisdom that he asked, but more wisdom than anyone before him or after him have ever had. The wisdom to discern right from wrong, to make the right judgments, the right calls on every situation. Not only am I going to give it more than anyone else, but I'm also going to bless you with riches beyond what anyone has ever had. And as we go forward and study in the next few weeks of Solomon, we'll see some of those riches. No one has ever come close to the riches of Solomon and what he had, and the wisdom and all of these things, and the honor. The honor being that he was so wise, people, leaders from other nations would travel to just sit and listen to his court, just give me a seat. Instead of us going to a ball game to watch one of our ball games, they would travel miles and miles to go just listen to Solomon make decisions so that they could learn and go back to their land. Or, well, these are leaders. These are kings, and Queen of Sheba comes, and all they just want to hear what Solomon has to say because of the wisdom that God has given him. But it's interesting when it says in verse 13, "And I have also given thee." He's given him riches. He's given him honor. He's given him the understanding that he wanted. "I have also given thee that which thou..." Well, let me go to 14. "And if thou wilt walk in my ways..." Instead of giving him long life as an absolute guarantee, he puts a condition on this one. The riches are coming. The honor's coming. I'm already giving you the understanding. But you got to be there's a condition on the long life. "And if thou wilt walk in my ways," if you'll walk with me, if you'll follow me, if you'll do what I say, "to keep my statutes and my commandments as thy father David did, then I will lengthen thy days." All right, if we stop the story there, we would immediately think that Solomon, in his wisdom, is going to live to be 500 years old. Because if God said, if you will follow my ways as your father did, I've given you all the wisdom that anybody's ever had. If you will follow me, I will lengthen thy days. When we study Solomon, Solomon died at 60. 60 years old. He reigned for 40 years. He started when he was 20. And for 40 years he reigned, similar to his dad. You know, Saul reigned for 40, David reigned for 40, Solomon reigned for 40, and then he died at 60 years of age, younger than his dad. Why? God had promised him a long life, but the condition was, if you walk in my ways. And we know Solomon's other love got the best of him and turned him from God, and he could not conditionally meet the standards that was needed for him to have long life. If you compare him, Solomon, to his father David, you would think, as you watch Solomon's life, let's go back to Gibeon when he sacrificed 1,000 bulls on the altar, all for God's glory. It told us that he loved the Lord, and he goes to Gibeon and he spends, I don't know, was it 1 day, 2 days, 10 days? I don't know how long it takes to sacrifice 1,000 offerings. But he did that as a show of his love to the Lord. In other words, he had an outward expression. He had the ability to express his love outwardly in a great capacity. No one in that crowd, why is Solomon doing all of this? 1,000 offerings. His love must be great with the Lord. He had the ability to outwardly show his love for God. But his father was different. His father had an inward love of God that he expressed with a personal relationship. We know David, and we study David's life. It was all about intimacy between him and God. When he would write his psalms, you could write these psalms, and they were almost like love letters. I long to be in your presence. You don't see this type of stuff with Solomon. Solomon was someone who liked to be very extravagant. He liked to be very outward. I have no doubt the Bible tells us that he loved the Lord, so we have to believe the Bible that he loved the Lord. But it doesn't tell us that he had this inward intimate relationship with the Lord like his father David did. That connection that David had, that personal connection, brought David such joy and longevity and protection. But yet Solomon doesn't seem to have or share that. In other words, he goes for the intimacy with others, like the strange women that he would marry. But yet he loved the Lord to a point where he will show it in his extravagant offerings. So with that, we know that we kind of get an idea on where Solomon is in life, is he's been given a whole lot more than any king has ever been given. But we also know that he's going to live a very short life comparatively to other kings who had all the advantages than the common man. And then it says, in verse 15, and Solomon awoke. After all this took place, after this whole dream that he's having, Solomon awakes out of the dream, and behold, or indeed, it was a dream. Solomon awakes, and behold, it was a dream. So what does he do? He's had the dream. It's as real to him as if God spoke to him personally, you know, as one-on-one. That dream changed Solomon. It changed his heart. It changed him. That dream that he had, even though it was a dream of what he was saying to God and what God was saying to him, he woke up, and yes, behold, it was a dream, but it changed him so much that it said, and he came to Jerusalem. He's in Gibeon. He's worshiping God in Gibeon with his offerings at the tabernacle with the brazen altar. What's back in Jerusalem that would make him get up? The Ark of the Covenant. David brought the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem and put it in a tent. The brazen altar is not there. He wakes up, realizes it was a dream, and he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And there he offered up burnt offerings and offered peace offerings and made a feast to all his servants. It's as if it transformed him. The dream itself, not only asking God for wisdom or hearing himself ask God for wisdom, but when he wakes up, he's a changed man. The wisdom, even through the dream itself, God has implanted the wisdom in Solomon, in his heart and in his mind. It transformed him in his sleep. So that now when he awakes, he knows, yes, it was a dream, but I'm a changed man because of the dream. It tells us that God doesn't have to speak to us in an audible voice. God speaks to us in various ways, even in dreams. Solomon believed the dream because he could tell something was different in himself, and he immediately gets up and doesn't go to the brazen altar that Moses had commanded to be built, and they had been using that brazen altar for hundreds of years. He goes back to Jerusalem where the Ark of the Covenant is, and he stands in front of it, and he offers up offerings there because he wants that intimacy with God. He knows that he has met the Lord, even in a dream, he's met him, and he is wanting to show his thanksgiving and his connection to the Lord by going to Jerusalem. It is as if the Bible is showing us that, yes, he made a decision in his own mind about, I'll go to Gibeon because that's where the biggest altar is. That's where I can do the most offering. I can fit 1,000 bulls in that area. Thinking outwardly, I'm going to show how I love the Lord by my outward appearance, by what I do and put on the show of it in the old tabernacle. But now that he's been transformed, I want the intimacy. I'm going to go to Jerusalem and stand in front of the actual Ark of God, and I'm going to offer in whatever capacity. It doesn't tell us how much, but I'm going to offer it instead of here in Gibeon. These days are over. The old covenant's gone. The old tabernacle, no use anymore. I'm going to the Ark of the Covenant, and that's where I'm going to make my connection with my Lord. And that's what he does. And it comes to an end at that time of how Solomon obtained this great wisdom that so many people speak of. When we talk about wisdom, I mean, all of us could probably ask, what is it, godly wisdom? Some people ask the question, what is wisdom versus just intelligence? There are some people that have great book learning. They can read a book and just photographically memorize it, and they know things as they read. And you always hated those people, didn't you? You just read a book and they know everything in it, and they could quote it back to you. And they're book learned. Some are just intelligent, born intelligent. They just seem to have knowledge. That's not what we were talking about. That's not the wisdom that God is seeking. That wasn't the wisdom that Solomon in his dream was asking of. He was asking for an understanding heart to judge, to make decisions. It wasn't book knowledge he was asking for. I don't want intelligence. I don't want to be the smartest man in the world. I want to be the wisest man in the world. You start seeing a difference between intelligence and wisdom. Wisdom is all about making decisions, the right decisions that affect the most people in the right way, hearing the complicated situation and being able to discern the right direction to go. Man, that's wisdom. Intelligence can't always give you that. A lot, that's why so many people will attribute wisdom to old age, because a lot of times experiences, life's experiences, will give you wisdom. And as you get older, we seem to gain more wisdom because of what we've seen, heard, felt, what we've gone through. That's wisdom that we've learned. You know, don't act this way when you're young, because you'll pay for it when you're old. I mean, that's a wise statement because you've learned it, right? You've gone through it. But godly wisdom is even beyond just experience and life's, you know, life's experiences. You know, we all kind of have a sense of common sense where, you know, when you rationalize things, here's the situation that I'm in, what do I need to do? Those with common sense make the most rational decision based on the facts around them. But understanding is being able to not only know the direction, but to know the consequences of making the wrong decision. I watched a show decades ago. It was a National Geographic show about a snake. And it's an animal show. And one snake was in the jungle, and another snake was hunting it. You know, there are other snakes eat other snakes. So the snake that the story was about could sense that the larger, more ferocious snake eater was near him, and he was in trouble. So common sense is, I'm evaluating the situation. My common sense says, I better run for my life as fast as I can to the nearest hole I can before this bigger snake catches me and eats me. That's common sense. So the common sense breaks forth with the younger snake. He darts off, and the bigger one, because snakes pick up vibrations with their tongue, the bigger snake knows, I got him. I know where he is. So he goes after the smaller snake. Common sense is not working out for the smaller snake, because common sense says rationalize him, outrun him. The rational thing is to outrun this snake. Wisdom settles in to this snake, and they didn't say this. This is me using this example. Wisdom settles into this snake to the point where he realizes, I can't outrun this bigger, larger, ferocious snake. He's going to catch me and eat me. Wisdom says, this snake chasing me knows where I am because I'm moving. He slams on the brakes and stops and lays there, knowing that the bigger snake is closing in on him. And as he stands there, lays there like a stick, the bigger snake stops. He's lost his track. He don't know where he is, because they don't see very well, and they can't discern. They do it with their tongue. They know where it's moving. And no lie, the camera showed this larger snake coming up to the smaller snake and literally crawling over his back, still looking for him, and he's right under his belly. He's crawling over the smaller snake because the smaller snake had enough wisdom to know, if I stop, this old boy's going to roll right over me and not even recognize me. And he did. The bigger snake kept going, looking for that vibration. What am I trying to say is, we all want wisdom instead of common sense. God-given wisdom is even greater because it affects individuals around us. We want the wisdom to affect not only our children, but our siblings, our family members, our co-workers, our church members. We want the type of wisdom that looks beyond just the facts that as they are, and gives us insight to how can we react to this, and what advice can I give my loved one or a friend or someone that has come to me with a problem? What kind of advice can I give that will change their lives, that will help them, truly help them in the direction where God gets the glory for the wisdom? Of course, the last part of the lesson tells us the great example that Solomon had, that the Bible tells us about the two harlots. The two harlots come to him. You know, he's sitting on the judgment seat, as he apparently did every day. People would come and say, I got a problem with my neighbor. He did this. And Solomon, you know, if it reached his level, I guess it'd say, if it reached the supreme level of Solomon, he would hear them out and he would render a decision. And he has two harlots that come together. And we know this story well, where they lived together. They were prostitutes. They lived together. And they both had children. But both each had a son, about the same exact age. And they all slept in the same bed, apparently, or it doesn't say, but they slept in the same house. And one of the harlots rolled over in the middle of the night and suffocated unknowingly her son, and the son dies. She wakes up in a panic. My son is gone. The very thing that I have dreamed about is having an offspring. My son is gone. So what am I to do? She looks over at the other prostitute whose baby is still alive, and she switches the baby out. You know, and then the second prostitute wakes up and says, "That's my baby." "No, it's not." And because there were no eyewitnesses, the two women know the truth, but no one else does. So they start going to the courts or to the judges in their province or wherever, and no one knows who to believe because they're both, it's her word versus her word. No one knows exactly what the baby, whose baby it belongs to. So it winds up in Solomon's court. And you could tell that they obviously were both very good at telling their side of things. The woman who was lying certainly had to be good because it reached all the way to Solomon. And the story tells us that Solomon is asking questions. And when he discerns that one of them is lying, God didn't tell him which one. You know, that's the gifting that, you know, sometimes we wish that, you know, we expect God to read we expect to read in the Bible where it says, "And God showed Solomon which one was telling the truth and which one was lying." That's the discernment we wish we had. You know, I want God to give me the discernment to know which one's lying. He didn't give Solomon the discernment of which one was telling the truth and which one was lying. Instead, the wisdom that Solomon already had obtained through God's gift made him make the decision, "Bring me a sword." Now, the women are thinking, "Is he going to kill us over this thing? Bring me a sword." And then when he gets the sword, he gives it to his assistant, says, "Cut the baby in half, give a half to each woman, and let them go." Now, immediately, the woman who's the true mother, and we know this story, the true mother immediately screams out, "No, no, no, don't do that. Give the baby to her. Give her to her. Just don't harm the baby. She can have the baby. Don't harm the baby." The woman who's lying, instead of just accepting that, her response is, "Go ahead and cut the baby in half." Now, Solomon knows through his understanding and his wisdom that only the true mother would be willing to give up the baby just to preserve its life. So immediately he renders the decision and gives the baby back to his rightful mother. The Bible makes it a point to bring out that example of wisdom that God has given Solomon. Quick decision-making skills that he can make a discernment right there and then that is the right one, that affects the right people, that takes the right, has the right knowledge and makes the right decision at the right time. That's God-given wisdom. And that's what I think when we read about Solomon, we should follow suit and ask him ourselves, ask the Lord ourselves, give us wisdom to make decisions. We're not the judge over a nation. You know, we're not going to lead thy great people, this great multitude that you've given us. That's not our prayer. Our prayer is, I live here in Thomasville or Davidson County, and I have family members, I have co-workers, I have decisions to make in my own life. Give me wisdom that I might know which way to go and what to say and what decision to make. And that's really what we discern from this. That's what we try to glean from this, is not only did God bless Solomon with wisdom beyond anyone has ever had, but yet we can still, he's not partial. He doesn't show favoritism. He gives to everyone liberally that ask. So we should ask for God to give us wisdom. Here again, as it closes the lesson in verse 28, it says, "And all of Israel heard of the judgment which the king had judged," talking about these two women, "and they feared the king. They feared him, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to do judgment." No more pulling things over on the judge. No more being able to lie your way out of things. Whenever someone makes the right decision seemingly all the time and can discern so much, there's a fear that people have over that person because now you can't fool them. They're not gullible. They're not foolable. And when God gives you that amount of discernment and God gives you that ability of wisdom, people may not fear you like a people feared the king, but they will respect you to a point where they know, I can't pull anything over on these folks. And there will be a respect given. And that's why, no matter what our age is, we all, as we've aged, have gained and garnered wisdom, but we want godly wisdom. We want the decision-making wisdom that God pours out to all those who ask. The sad part of Solomon, as we continue to read this, is that God's wisdom did not take away the fault that he had. He was still a human being with faults, and he still made bad decisions in his own regard about his own life. And that's the part that we hopefully maybe can study out more and more, because if you can make decisions that will help other people and that make the right decisions as a judge to all the people, but yet you can't make the right decisions on your own life, that tells us there that it is something that we have to be aware of ourselves, not to get overconceited in our own wise wisdom. And if we've come through life doing pretty good for ourselves and making good decisions, don't get to a point where we're conceited with it. We still have to seek God's face to say, show me wisdom, even as an older person. Give me wisdom to make the right decisions, especially as I get older. More people will look towards me when I get older. They'll ask me when I get older. When I get older, sometimes I can't remember things like I used to, but give it to me even greater. Give me an outpouring of the wisdom, because I need it now more than I did when I was younger. This is what we learn from Solomon. Next week, we're going to get into the actual temple, the building of the temple. And here again, the outward showing of what Solomon does with his love of God is unmatched as well. I mean, his offerings and all of that. So we'll